Where are you from originally, John?
Born at Providence Hospital in Detroit.
So was I.
In 1950.
I was born at the old Providence at 14th and the Boulevard. It was torn down. I was born there December 31st, 1924, the old Providence Hospital.
Okay.
And then a new Providence Hospital was built. Where, out on Avon Road someplace?
No, I was born in the Detroit one. 50, October 8th, 1950.
Well, they're still open then, probably.
Hmm?
The one I was born in was still there then?
I'm guessing, because...
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway.
So you were a Detroiter.
Yeah, but a funny Detroiter in that my folks had dated from like 34 or 5 until 49.
During the Depression, yeah.
Yeah, and was second family for my mom. And... they had several friends. My mom was working at U.S. Rubber, a switchboard operator. She was kind of the coordinator of switchboard. My dad was a CPA at a downtown firm. They had met when she was an elevator operator downtown. And
I worked at the Dime Bank building downtown in Griswold.
Okay. So they had some friends that were moving in different neighborhoods and so on and so forth. And a couple of the friends moved out to Birmingham just by the train tracks, just off of the,
yeah.
Used to be people did commuter lines and did,
yeah.
My mom would tell stories about taking the trolley, and people nowadays can't believe me that there were trolleys when I was a kid in the 50s even. But my dad died right after I was born, like 3 months later. My mom stayed there. But my brother and his three kids, all my aunts and uncles, everybody was East Siders except for one who lived on the West Side. So I used to know, you know, St. Martin Tours Parish was my brother's parish, and somebody at Harper was his parish.
I was a West Sider. We only went on the East Side once a year to visit our East Side relative. Other than that, you never crossed Woodward Avenue. The funny thing was like two different worlds.
I had one aunt and uncle that lived on the West Side.
Yeah.
So people talk about West Side Detroit, and I barely, even after we worked on this Detroit book and stuff, still wasn't sort of come familiar to me.
Yeah, I knew every street in the West Detroit, yeah.
Yeah, but so I know Jeff Chalmers' neighborhood and moving on up.
Is that Hamtramck or for Idle Park?
That picture?
Yeah. It looks like Hamtramck plant, but it could be a Ford plant, but I'm not sure.
I'm sorry, there's hundreds of pictures in there. We did that book in the early 80s. That picture...
But I haven't lived through all that. All
oh, time. I know, and that's...
You notice one thing about the labor movement? All white, and most of them were pretty well-dressed. Most of them had a high school education, and they had read a couple of books, including a couple of radical books.
Uh-huh.
So they knew what they were doing. Uh-huh. They were, in other words, much better informed than the average worker today.
Absolutely. And in fact...
much more class-conscious.
The prime author on this, Steve, ended up doing, at the time we did this book, he wasn't a faculty member. He was actually a PhD candidate at Wayne State.
Uh-huh.
He ended up doing his dissertation on the Anglo-Irish roots of the UAW leadership.
Oh, God.
And so his dissertation is all about people like Doug Fraser who have backgrounds going back to Ireland or Scotland or whatever.
Scotch-Irish. It was Celtic, Scotch-Irish type,
And
I knew Doug well, nice guy.
He was a great guy. I had the privilege of doing
some... And then the other guy, the only honest guy, he called me the only honest guy, Bobby Holmes, he was Scotch. He was from Scotland.
Okay.
Bobby Holmes, remember that name?
Oh, I don't remember if we interviewed him for this book or not, but we've interviewed him at some point. We did a series of sort of videos related to this, and I brought some stuff I'll leave that just tells you a little bit about me and stuff. But, for this book, we didn't do Bobby Holmes, but we, I think, did him on some other projects.
Uh-huh.
But in this video, which is kind of a takeoff of some of my other stuff that the TV stations did, I don't know if you ever saw that on TV a few years back.
I'm sure I've seen it.
I'm kind of a talking head. I could lend it to you if you want. Doug Fraser is also a talking head on that one.
Well, I was a kid in Detroit right up to the time... I was around when the workers marched to Highland Park marched to the Ford Rouge plant peacefully, and a couple of them got killed by the cops shot at them, and nothing ever came of it. That was back in, 33 or 34.
Well, the Hunger March, if that's what you're talking about, is 32.
32 was it? Well, I was 5 years old. I remember it.
I didn't know
my dad taught about it.
Oh, really? What was your dad doing at that time?
My dad was kind of a businessman. He worked at a sausage company, then he went to the bar and nightclub business.
Huh.
And
you were looking on the west side of Detroit?
Yeah, west side. St. Teresa's Parish, they identified everybody by what church you went to.
Yeah.
That was the St. Teresa's Parish.
So what neighborhood, Sam?
That would be near Dry Road and Grand River.
Okay.
And that was the prime shopping area in Detroit at the time. In the 20s, early 30s, that was considered the best shopping area in Detroit. And that's where my dad moved when he married my mother in 24. Yeah.
Wow. So, here's a couple pictures of the hunger march in 32.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think how many? Two were killed, weren't they? Was it two or four?
Actually, it's five. There was a black man who was
shot right at him. It was really,
yeah.
And then the papers hardly were sympathetic at all. It was really pathetic.
Only much more recently did they finally do the grave markers. Local 600 were cut.
Abject cruelty. And had it been properly publicized, it would have been but it wasn't nearly as provocative as it should have been because it wasn't well covered, you know?
So you recall that from being a kid. What do you recall later in terms of things before your career started when you still...
Well, when I was a kid, my father was a first-generation Irish, born in this country. His mother and father were both from Ireland,
mm-hmm.
came over as immigrants in the 1880s. And my father was born in 93, and when he was 19 years old, that same year, his mother and father both died. The grandmother died of what they call childbirth fever,
okay.
which is because the doctor wouldn't wash their hands.
Oh.
Nothing's changed. They said, there's a Frenchman named Louis Pasteur says there's such thing as bacteria. You should wash your hands. Mm-hmm. So guess what the average doctor in America said? What do those crazy Frenchmen know? They don't know anything.
Mm.
So 50,000 people, women, died a year from childbirth fever because of the ignorance of American doctors. And my grandmother was one of them. And then my grandfather died. Detroit Grassworks, the foundry, was working in a foundry and a drop forge hit him in the stomach, and he died of internal bleeding on the job 3 days later. He was afraid to complain about it, but probably nothing. He died from internal hemorrhaging on a job at the Detroit Brass Works. So my father and his brothers and sisters were orphaned, and there were three or four children younger than him. There were eight altogether, and they pulled together and did all right. One of the older brothers, ironically, became chief of personnel of Ford Motor Company.
Is that your uncle then?
My uncle Tom Kelly, and uh-huh. guess what? You remember the infamous Harry Bennett?
Sure.
Well, the infamous Harry Bennett, my uncle Tom had to be fired. They fired him in order to make a job for Harry Bennett. They fired my uncle in 1929 for no reason, and then hired Harry Bennett in his position and made him chief of personnel and broadened his powers.
Had your dad, had that uncle gone to school or something to get that kind of job?
No. They're just smart Irish. Seventh grade education. Well, Ford didn't believe in education. Anyway, Henry Ford.
Uh-huh.
He didn't believe in it. He wanted no, he didn't want any college graduate engineers. He didn't want any college graduate CPA. He didn't believe in a lot of education. He believed in innate intelligence, which he had, which allowed him to become chief engineer at Detroit Edison Company before he ever built a car.
Uh-huh.
So he had to be a pretty sharp guy. But my Uncle Tom was a sharp guy. And they were all my dad's and his brothers were all smart.
How many were there?
There were my uncle Dave, Tom, Frank, Harold, and Martin, five boys and three girls. And in those days, if you had a fifth grade education, you were doing pretty good. Around 1900.
So they all go to parochial schools then?
I don't know where they went. Yeah, they went to parochial school, I guess.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Where'd you go?
I went to St. Teresa's through the ninth grade, and then the nuns skipped me. They skipped me from the seventh grade to the ninth grade, and that didn't work out. I didn't like it. So then I went out to UD High for a year, and I didn't like that because the richest Catholic kids in town were there, you know. I had to take two buses and a streetcar to get there, and they come to school in their cars. They either have a chauffeur or they come in a car. So I enjoyed the company and met a lot of good friends. But I got tired of the ritual. So the nuns that skipped me originally at St. Teresa's, by that time had moved to another parish. And my mother called and complained and said, well, don't worry about that. Just send Frank to this new high school we're at. and we'll tell everybody that he's older. They won't know the difference. And I went to visitation, and I went to junior senior year, and I was a VIP there. I was leading the senior play and leading the senior play and junior play, senior play, and class officer, all that kind of stuff. And I graduated 41 from visitation, but I was only about 15 and a half, 16 years old when I graduated.
Wow.
Very, very immature. And then I went to UD, made a UD college, made a mess of it. I was out of there in a semester, didn't study, and I didn't flunk out, but I just got discouraged, and I didn't go back. And I lied about my age again, got a job at defense plan.
What defense plan?
Continental Motors on Jefferson Avenue, making tank.
On the east side?
On the east side, yeah.
Yeah.
East Jefferson. And I had a job there for a while. And then a friend I met there said, well, why don't you, after I had one semester of failed college, I was 17. He said, well, why don't we go out to some, you're going to be drafted then someday. And why don't we go out to Arizona? I'm a tennis pro. He had been Big Ten double champ. Then him, Harvey Hagnati. So why don't we go to Arizona and go to some sunny school and have a good time and work our way through out there and live in the sun? So I talked to my dad and mother. My dad had such an adventure about him. And he just didn't see anything wrong with it. So he approved. So we went out to Arizona. I went to Arizona State. And after one semester, my guy flew the coop and went on stayed someplace else on campus. And so then I roomed with Steve Allen, who later became head of the Tonight Show. You remember? Remember Steve Allen?
Yeah.
Well, he was my roommate at Arizona State College. So I was in with very intellectual type guys.
You know, they were funny guys.
Well, yeah, but he was very smart, very radical. He was a Trotskyite socialist.
I didn't know that.
When I met him, he was. And of course, I was going to these Catholic schools, but my father was very progressive. And I started during the Depression. You go in a bookstore. There was a lot. Unlike today, you went in a bookstore, then there'd be a display. There'd be 10 or 15 radical books, like Strachey writing books and different guys writing books about the failure of the industrial system and all that kind of stuff. Well, I got into that a little bit and became kind of a sophomore rebel. Well, then when I met guys like Steve Allen, I just made I was even more radicalized. And my dad didn't care, but he said to me, he said, my dad was very well read, even though he went to the fifth grade. He was very well read and could hold his own in college. He gave me a quote from Oscar Wilde, about today's conservatives wax eloquent quoting yesterday's radicals. He said, when you grow up and get out in the real world, you're going to have to face conservatives and they're going to judge you very harshly. He said, so whatever you do, don't use your real name. You want to get in all these radical causes, just remember you're John Smith and you and some address over in Grand River. You're not Frank Kelly and you don't live here. I said, okay. So I was John Smith. Oh, and I belonged to the Socialist Labor Party and I get all kinds of radical literature and stuff.
In Arizona or back in Detroit?
Both, before I went and when I went. And as I say, I was kind of radical when I went. And then being with Steve Allen didn't help matters any because he was worse than I was.
That's just a
and
semester.
And then he died a reactionary. He died a conservative, right-wing conservative. He died a complete right-wing conservative.
Sort of a Reagan, but even more so?
Return like a lot of neurotic radicals do, you know. Like all the communists became Catholics, you know. Whitaker Chambers, that crowd. And so I was identifiable liberal in those days, progressive. And so having that kind of a background, although I never did much about it except that it was a personal philosophy. So as I got older and went through all these so-called radical movements, I thought that most of these so-called radicals were a bunch of silly, superficial fools that didn't even know what radicalism was.
Uh-huh.
And I used to laugh at them. And I kept my views to myself. And, of course, I became a little more conservative as I got older, realizing that there's a big difference between reality and theory, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I live in a real world, and in order to succeed in the real world, I've got to do what the real world requires, you know. Be a good boy and go to law school and say all the right things.
Did you do your undergrad first, though?
Well, I went to school. As I said, I went out to UD, I flopped. And then I went out to Arizona. I took courses like, elementary, but also I took very important courses like Survey of American Tennis, Playboy person. And then I, but then when I came back to go in the Army. Well, first of all, one of the reasons I went to Arizona is I had a bad ear. I had a very bad ear and was draining and infected. There was no penicillin and no sulfa drug. And though this infected ear was such that had I had those drugs, it would have been cured in 24 hours. But it wasn't, and it made the ear, all I could hear out of it was very, 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 very inhibited. And I thought I couldn't, I wanted to become an officer in the Army. And so I had J. Milton Robb, a doctor, operated on my nose. His theory was, if he operated on my nose and I went to a hot, dry climate, I would approve the irrigation, maybe that ear would clear up on its own. There was no drugs. And then maybe I could get in the Army. So that's one of the reasons I went to Arizona, too. And that was why my family approved, and because that was a hot, dry climate. And ironically, when I got out there, it did heal well. And then what happened was I wanted to get in the Navy V-5 program. They had V-8s and V-5s. They had a different program where college kids could enroll. And if you stayed in, you could go to officer school when they called you, you know. Okay. Well, I wanted to get in the V-5, and I looked pretty good. I'll be damned if they didn't subcontract the Navy V-5. They subcontract to a local doctor to examine me. And he was a quack. And I go to him, and the son of a gun puts a great big bulb with water and hot water. He blows out of my ear, and he blew all the healing, all the scar tissue, all the surgery, everything went out, and their ear was ruined. Well, then I couldn't get a service. I was really mad after that, really upset. But that's what happened. It was one of my aftermath of my trip to Arizona, which was to get me ready to go into service. I couldn't get into service. And a bum ear, and I couldn't get in. And then when I came back, I went on the draft board, and he said, forget it, you know, you got a bum ear. So I never did make it.
So you went to the draft board in Detroit in 42 or 3, something like that?
Let me think. When I turned 18, within a month they called me, and I went down, and I was, you know, I couldn't be accepted because of the ear, which made me mad. And this is a thing you get a kick out of, John. This is a sad story. In front of me was a kid that I went to high school with. And back of me was a kid I went to high school with. That draft board that day. One was killed in the Pacific, and the other was killed in the Atlantic within 120 days. Mm. I figured, I wasn't religious, but I thought, I'm sure I'm a lucky Irishman, you know?
You weren't religious then? After all that visitation?
Well, I was doubting, put it that way. I was a doubting child.
Okay.
I know, I still went to church and stuff.
Okay.
For example, well, I can tell you a story about that. One morning I got up at Arizona State in the dormitory with Steve Allen. Now, in Arizona State, we had to sleep on a porch. It was a health nut place.
Okay.
And so you in your room, all you had was a desk and a cabinet for clothes. And then you would go to the porch, and you all sleep on a porch, like a dormitory. And then when you come in the morning. So I came in the morning to get ready to go to church, to get dressed to go to church. And the reason I went to church was, one of the reasons was, that helped motivate me, was there was an Irish priest on the edge of the campus, had the church. Well, if you went there and acted as an altar boy,
okay.
After that, you got to go up into the priest house with him and have a great breakfast, ham and eggs and toast and coffee, and listen to him talk for a while and have a great time, piece of apple pie, and come home. So sort of kind of half hungry and half religious, I went to the church. But get this one. I get up in the morning, and Steve Allen says, where were you going, you Irish Catholic Jew? And I said, I'm going to church, you atheistic bastard. And he said, well, you're making too much noise. And I said, well, and I made more noise, and I went out. And then I'm gone about 3 hours, okay? But I come amble back. And in the meantime, he was a natural-born piano player. I don't know whether you remember Schultz. His mother was a star piano player named Belle. I don't know her last name. I don't know whether it was Belle Allen or what it was. But she was a star piano player in vaudeville. In other words, any big-time act would hire Belle to play piano for him. He was raised backstage. His father left him when he was young. And
is he from the East or West?
He was from Chicago area. But they played, he was on Keith Orville. He was on a circuit all the time. He never had any home. Anyway, I'm at church this day, he sits down at the piano. And I come back, and I said, well, what'd you do when I was gone? He said, I wrote a song. I said, you did? I said, yeah. He said, play it. He plays a song. And he's an atheist. I mean, he doesn't believe in anything. Let's go to church next Sunday morning. He writes a song. And guess what? When he became famous about 5 or 6 years later, he gave the song to a famous singer. I can't think of it. He was the first hillbilly crossover. And come to me. But he gave it to him. He recorded it. And what's the name? Made several thousand dollars in royalties. Steve Allen. the atheist writing a song about going to church.
And I assume he was Jewish?
No, he was not Jewish. A lot of the Jews thought he was Jewish. He was not Jewish. He was Irish, 100% Irish.
Really?
Oh, yeah, that's how we got along. We got along because we used to, we both loved the Jewish culture. We both loved the Jews, and we used to have more fun. And I used to say he was Jewish just to sit around, you know. Yeah. But he wasn't. He was Irish.
What year were you born again?
Huh?
What year did you say you were born?
December 31st, New Year's Eve, 1924. Everybody gets drunk on my birthday. Yeah. But anyway, that was I had to get that story out. And that's when I was in Arizona. And then when I came back, then I had this cold reality of not going to go to war. Then I started getting serious. And, you know, I'm 18. I started to mature a little bit. And I said, well, this is nonsense. So get this one. You talk about, I may have questions about religion, but I don't question well-intentioned religious people. In other words, there are a lot of the well-intentioned religious people that devote their life to this, and I'm not going to knock it. Who the hell am I to knock it? I'll give you an example. I'm working for Mr. Hyman, who owned the United Shirt Stores in Detroit. He had 30 of them. He was a Russian-Jewish guy, nice guy. Anyway, I get a job. I come back, and I get a job there about this time of year. Went in maybe 2 weeks before Christmas help at his number one store, which is downtown at the corner of Griswold and Michigan there, right? It was the United Shirt. It was right in the corner. It's a Coney Island now, but it was flagship United Shirt store. And he hired a lot of help for Christmas, okay? So I'm down there working there, and 5 days after Christmas, they're all fired. Hired the Gentile kids for the holidays, you know. So I figured, out, well, I'm not going to get fired. I like it here. And the guys that ran the place, same, you remember Van Horn's store in Northland? It was a Van Horn clothing store? Neil Van Horn. Well, Neil and Sam, they were Dutch Jewish boys. Holland Dutch Jewish boys. Handsome. One more handsome than the other. Look at movie stars. And they both worked as managers for Old Man Hyman in different stores. Sam had the store downtown. Neil had already left, and because he had a store near my neighborhood, and my mother knew him, and so we knew him. So when I went down to work in Detroit and for Sam, I said, I know your brother Neil. That's how I got hired. Well, Neil had already opened Van Horn. They were the nicest guy in the world. Anyway, I figured out, how can I be kept on after the holidays are over? And so I said, the day after Christmas, I said, let me handle the beefs. I'm Irish. I'll take care of it. Let me handle these returns, okay? I'll take care of the return. You guys don't do it. Send them to Mr. Kelly, okay? So these people would come in there, and about, so help me God, about every fifth one, babushka or something on them, crazy. Say, you Jews, you cheated me. They'd come up with some anti-Semitic stuff, you know, and I'm ready for them. I'd say, madam, you shouldn't talk like that. I said, I can't help the way I was born. Aren't I a nice guy? Am I a nice guy? I'm going to do whatever you want me to do. I'll do whatever you want me to do. You shouldn't talk like that. Well, all my buddies there picking that up. They broke their ass to call Old Man Hyman, the head of the company, and said, Kelly's over here, he's defending us every day. He said, you lay off all those going, but don't lay off Frank Kelly. You know? And so I was kept on, and we had a wonderful time. But then on a spring day, I was there about April, May, and I walked downtown. I walked all the way over to Jefferson Avenue to where the U of D Law School is now. Well, it was across the street in those days. The building where the law school is now, it was a boarded up, condemned building. It was all boarded up. And across the street was a modern building built during around World War I called Dinan Hall. And in that building was the law school and the dental school. So I walked down Jefferson Avenue, and they have a big bulletin board in front of the building. And I'm standing there on a hot summer day on my dinner hour, lunch, reading the bulletin board. And out comes this priest with a Roman collar and no shirt on. You know, you can see his short sleeves. And just kind of relaxed, big, tall guy. And he comes out the door, and I'm looking at the bulletin board, and he said to me, young man, can I help you? I said, no, Father, it's too late for me. I had my chance. I said, it's too late for me. I've had my chance. I've been to college. I screwed it all up. He says, you're wrong. I said, I am? He said, yeah. He says, I'm placed here. That's my job here, is to help people like you. My job is to give you people like you a second chance. You understand that? I said, oh, okay, but he said, you come in my office right now. Before I whip in. 15 minutes later, he's got me signed up for 10, a night school, 10 credit hours of night school, okay? Which would be 3 nights a week, 3 hours a night to start with. He says, you're in. You're in on probation and under my recommendation. Now, I want you to start over and make, you got a car? I said, well, I can get my dad's car until I get a car. I said, fine. Get down here and go to school. I said, this is my chance. Well, my dad's going to hell with you. Guess what? I went to 7 years of night school. Never missed a class in 7 years. And picked up my pre-law and my law degree in 7 years. And the guy that helped me, Father Wurttemberg, I mean, he saved my life. You talk about people saving your life. That's why I've always been mentor-oriented. I always try to help people. I got a lot of proteges I can name for you that I helped. And because I believe that at key points in your life, an older person can help you. And if you're old and you don't help people, there's something wrong with you. So anyway, I remember, so afterwards, later on, I had an oil painting made, and I hung it in the library of Father Wittenberg. And it just says, from an appreciative student. I don't know if it's still in that library down there or not. I don't know. But anyway, and that's what happened. And I wound up going there, and I went for a couple of years. And then after a couple of years, I went with a girl that I married, Josephine. And then in 1945, I'm only 20 years old, but I've been knocked around for 5 years, you know. I'm like 20, but I'm going on 27, you know, the experience I've had. So I got married when I was 20, and that made school a lot easier to be married and, you know, have the convenience of an apartment and wife, and you're not chasing around doing anything. And it was wonderful. And that enabled me to go to school with ease. And so by 1961, I graduated from law school. And I was okay.
Give you a sense to catch your breath. Those are great stories. I'm sorry I didn't have videotape. I just had audio tape. Could you just give me, I'm hoping that we can schedule again when you come back from Florida.
All right.
For another time. Well,
what do you want to get at? I mean, I just give you some background so you know me.
Right.
And, you know, because I came from very, very ordinary circumstances. Well, my dad always made money. We were never poor. My father was a poor orphan, but I wasn't, you know. When I was born, my father bought me a Shetland pony, and we had a beautiful summer home up north, and he drove a big Cadillac car, or a Packard. I was never poor, but I didn't know that. And I always went to work, and my dad would let me go to work at 14 because he did it. And then when he realized I was away from home, he got mad. He wouldn't let my baby brother, he wouldn't let them work in the summer because he wouldn't see it. He wouldn't let them work. He'd let me work, which is good because I got more experience. The more experience, the better. You know that.
I love
my father. I thought he was the greatest guy in the world. And I still, to this day, think he's one of the smartest guys I ever knew. I still try to please him, you know. I'm trying to please my father here, 50 years later. 60 years later. He died when I was 27. I'm still trying to please. I'm 87, so I've been trying to please him for, 50 years.
You just asked me a question. I'm going to try to answer it. And background is perfect, and I'm going to come back to those mentees in a second. I want to just get the list from you, and then we can talk about it again. I'm hoping you'll be willing that I can come back when you come back from Florida and do another interview.
What are you going to do with this, by the way?
Okay, a couple things. This project.
Because I got a book coming out next year. You know Jack Lessenberry?
Yeah.
He's writing he and I are working on a book. It'll be out next year. But that's the whole story, you know.
I thought there was another form here. The point of this is to try to do something related to the history of unions in Michigan and politics in
Which
Michigan.
Which I think is one of the most neglected. I'm so mad. You know what I used to do when I got interviewed college kids right out of college? I'd say, did you ever, obviously they didn't get your course. I said, did you ever get a course on labor union? Did you ever get a course on how labor was exploited? Did you ever get a course on the history of workers? No, no, no. Do you understand anything about it? No, no, no. I'm so mad about it, you know. So obviously anything I can do to encourage the history of workers in Michigan, I'll be glad to help.
And I think I gave your assistant another sheet that she had, which listed two projects that I thought you could help me on. And it'll be helpful to know what you and Jack Lessenberry did about this. One relates to sort of unions activity in Michigan, both in terms of election activity and in terms of lobbying, and what you think have been sort of in your whole career. So it could take us a little while. And you could tell me, no, I already talked to Jack 5 times about that, so let's skip it. And I can listen to his tapes. But unions activity in doing elections and in lobbying in terms of your career. And I'll show you a couple books that I know have quoted you before, and I wanted to ask you some follow-ups to some of those questions.
Well, I don't do any lobbying. I never have.
No, but you were lobbied.
No, I don't do any lobbying.
You were lobbied.
Huh?
You know.
Well, I was lobbied. Yeah. When I set up this law firm, which does a lot of lobbying between you and I, but I personally don't do lobbying.
Right. No, I wasn't asking. I was talking about unions lobbying.
Oh, they didn't have to lobby me. I was a colleague. They didn't have to lobby me.
No, but they. Yeah. Anyways, but in terms of in your career, the labor movement had times when they were very successful, and they've had times when they're not doing very well.
Right.
And I wanted to get some of your thoughts about that, and then also about the in Michigan at various points. We've had originally called a bureau, then it became a Department of Labor, and then it became DLEG, and now it's licensing. And I think you'd have some unique things from your perspective about kind of Department of Labor and some civil rights kinds of stories. And again, you might have done a lot of interviews on it, but I'm just kind of looking at that labor angle about some of those questions. But I got to go back, if you don't mind, on the...
Go where you set the time, Bill. I just give you a little background.
I'm just curious, so when I come back to ask again, who were some of that, you were starting to list people that you were mentor to, and you started to say, well, there's been a lot of people that I sort of was mentor, I really believe in that.
Well, I gave Carl Levin his first job when he got out of law school.
Uh-huh.
Carl Levin came to me, and I gave him a job, and he wanted to be in Detroit because he didn't want to be away from his family connection. There, Sandra was already well known, and Carl was not. Carl was a younger brother, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave him a job, and at that time, I believe Sandra might have been in the legislature. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I gave Carl a job, and he was just out of Harvard, and he wanted to live in Detroit. I discouraged that because I wanted my lawyers to be up here with me. You know, a lot of them would want to live in Detroit. Well, I discouraged. But in with his case, because I knew his brother and everything, I made an exception because I was going to set up a civil rights division. And a civil rights division should be in Detroit for practical reason. So I made him head of my civil rights division, Attorney General Civil Rights, and I set him up in Detroit. He did that for about 3 years, made a lot of good connections in Detroit, then he ran for councilman in Detroit. And so I helped launch him that way, which you'll give me credit for. And I was, you know, helped him along the way. And then Jim Blanchard was a protege of mine, and Congressman Dennis Hertel was an intern of mine. T. John Osinski, I took him to his first political party in law school. He was a protege of mine. He became Lieutenant Governor, Chief Judge, mm-hmm. Court of Appeal. And that's a few of them.
Okay. Well, that's
Bill Cahalan.
Who?
Bill Cahalan became prosecutor and Recorder's Court Judge.
Mm-hmm.
And, Vince Brennan, who later became a judge in Detroit. I don't know anyway.
I don't know that one.
Vince Brennan, he was Vincent Brennan. He was 6'4", he died young. And that was some of them. I can think of more later.
In a lot of
you can ask them. They will all acknowledge that they were.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing for a guy to say he's a protege. It's another thing for the protege to say he was, you know.
Yeah. Here's just a side question, and it might be something that Lessenberry would have asked you about. So there was a time period in my life, I'm 61, there's a time period in my life that people would say if you wanted to run in the Democratic Party, it didn't matter what your track record was, as long as you had an Irish name, you had a better chance. But that wasn't always true in your lifetime.
Well, put it this way, the Irish, it's like, it's all historical. When the Irish came here in 1845 with the potato famine, they were kind of a horde mob. They came over here semi-literate, and the WASP society that was here, the White Angles, they didn't like them because they were anti-British and they were Catholic, and they didn't like that either. And they were, for the most part, uneducated and rather coarse and unpolished around the edges. And so starting about 1850, signs all around Detroit until 1900, there would be signs all over Detroit, help wanted, Irish need not apply.
Right.
Now in 1880s, you can get this from the Chicago Tribune. It was a Chicago paper, you probably read it. It was a front page editorial in the Chicago paper in the 1870 something. They've got it. They know about it. What are we going to do about the Irish? Front page editorial. They are such a lawless mob of violent, drunken, disorderly, and criminal type people. It's so bad that the blacks that sent the story in there, the blacks don't want anything to do with them. What do we do about these terrible Irish? And that's the image they had in the 1870s, 1880s. Well, boom, they started getting education, they first got to school. By 1900, they had sheer numbers, and they had educated few leaders, and the people that already got no Irish history, which I do, is that you want to remember that during the 500 years of British persecution, what was the persecution? You could not go to school, become a professional, you couldn't vote, you couldn't run for office, and you couldn't own property. Well, what the hell do you want to get over there? How are you going to get power? If you've been powerless for 500 years, how do you get power? We take. Why do Jewish people contribute so much to politics? Because goddamn it, we're going to be considered by somebody who's ever in power. They're going to have some compassion for our judgment, or else, you know, we're trying to. Well, the Irish not only could see that, but they could be part of the leadership, because they had the numbers. The Jewish people never had the numbers, you know. So by 1890 they got elected. So the show the switch in Chicago. By 1910, the mayor and all of the principal council, principal politicians in Chicago were Irish. They took over, and so once that happened about 1910, it happened to every major city that had Irish, and so they could get elected, and they start getting elected, and so and the other thing about it was once they elected them, they figured out number one, they tend to be loyal, and they tend to be dramatic, they tend to be articulate, and they tend to be entertaining, and so they would get reelected, you know, and they weren't all crooks, a lot of them were good people. The greatest politician Michigan ever produced was Frank Murphy.
That's what I was just going to show you.
Yeah, well, Frank Murphy, I know all about Frank Murphy. He's a friend of my father's. And Frank Murphy, one time my dad was such a good politician that George Welsh was running for governor in a Michigan primary, thinking there'd be nobody in the primary in 1936. Little did he know that Roosevelt was going to call on Frank Murphy to come back to the Philippines and run. So after Welsh gets his campaign started, Murphy comes back out of nowhere in the spring of 36 and is a candidate. So one night we're up at our summer home in northern Michigan. Frank Murphy called my dad and said, I understand you got a cool house. Can I stay at your house tonight? He stayed at my house. Well, Frank Murphy was staying in our house in Detroit, and George Welsh was staying in our house. My dad had both candidates for governor under his roof at one night. So that's the way I knew Frank Murphy. But anyway, Frank Murphy started off as a good student at U of M, and you want to remember, there's so many things that people don't know about, that prior to the modern age, the Jesuit leadership in the Catholic Church, which was the University of Detroit, carried this for years. You can't go to University of Michigan. It's prejudice against Catholics. And the reason for that is, the basis for it, John, was that the college was started by Gabriel Richard, a Catholic priest, who died during a cholera epidemic in Detroit, giving last extreme unction to people in the street. Okay? And so, once that happened, then the board of the University of Michigan became all Masonic members. Well, boy, the Catholics and the Masons hate each other in those days. It was really WASP versus the Catholics, you know. And so the U of M became an all Masonic board. Well, that gave the inroad. So then every secular priest and every Jesuit went to every parish in Detroit and said, you cannot send your children to the University of Michigan. They will lose their religion. And guess what? I never knew of anybody. My father never. I never knew of a Catholic from Detroit that went to U of M. Frank Murphy was from Harbor Beach. His father was a lawyer and a liberal guy. He never heard of it. No priest called on him to do it. So he sent Frank to U of M. So U of M, smart. They were smart. Whenever they got in trouble being anti-Catholic, they trot out Frank Murphy to defend him. But anyway, Frank Murphy went to Detroit and he became a smash. What happened was, he got to be elected. He got elected. He taught at UAD law school. Then he got elected circuit judge. He was a assistant prosecutor. He elected circuit judge, and he lucked out and became a judge in the Sweet Trial with Clarence Darrow. And Clarence Darrow promoted him nationally, and he became a big figure. And then he ran for mayor of Detroit. Okay. So then he's mayor of Detroit, and he's a big bleeding heart liberal, and he makes all these wonderful speeches about the poor and everything. And he was a sincere man, no question about it. He was a true liberal. And wonderful, wonderful guy. But I'll tell you a secret weapon you never knew about it. Yeah. Yeah, that's Frank Murphy right there. Mayor Murphy, second from right, and residents of the city, official lodge, the unemployed. Yeah. Now, I'll tell you, ask you now if you know your. Do you know what his secret weapon was? He had a person close to him was his secret weapon for his career, which made his career. You know what it was?
No.
He was good at his own. You got the history there. But when he became mayor of Detroit, he had a male secretary. Yeah. And the male secretary was Eleanor Roosevelt's only brother.
Oh, okay.
G. Hall Roosevelt, a brother who she loved.
Oh. Okay.
And who tended to be a drunk and a wastrel, but she loved him. He was her baby brother. She felt very protective of him. And therefore, she wrote him and called him several times a month. And since Frank Murphy was taking care of her baby brother, Frank Murphy was gold to her, and thereby gold with Franklin Roosevelt.
Which helped explain why he decided to run for governor.
No. It was even better than that. Before that, so Murphy quits being mayor, okay? He didn't want him to be mayor anymore. So what does Eleanor come up with? Franklin, I don't think G. Hall should spend those winters in Detroit. You've got that job over the Philippines. It's still a protectorate. Not free.
Mm-hmm.
There's called, you're the Governor General.
Yep.
Governor General of the Philippines. I want you to send Frank Murphy and he'll take G. Hall over to the Philippines. So, boom, Frank Murphy goes, and Frank Murphy jumped at it. He loved horse riding. He loved putting on airs. He always a big liberal. He loved to be with rich people, you know, like a lot of liberals, like a Jesuit priest. They always like to be around rich people, even though they think about poverty. But anyway, he went over there and lived like a king in a castle So he was there for whatever, 2 or 3 years, and boom, Roosevelt in 36, he wants to make sure he carries Michigan. He summons him because of the connection with G. Hall. Says, Eleanor, call G. Hall, come Murphy. And Murphy comes back dutifully to run for governor because Roosevelt requested him to. But the secret weapon was always G. L. Roosevelt. Why? What happens after he loses for governor? Eleanor Roosevelt says, Franklin, you got to take care of Frank Murphy. Well, out of nowhere, turns around the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens? He's so righteous and so strict, he indicts Pendergast, much to Roosevelt's embarrassment. He's indicting every political boss in America. Roosevelt's going crazy. What are you, nuts? So then he has to put him on the Supreme Court. I don't want to be quoted directly on that, but I'm just giving you background.
No, I get you.
But that's Murphy. I know him backward.
Right.
And the secret weapon was G. Hall Roosevelt.
So what I want to bridge to is, so when you are working in downtown Detroit in a clothing store and stuff,
yeah,
and then you go into law school, and then you decide why to get into politics, and what role, if any, does being Irish play in that?
Oh, well,
In Detroit,
I had two things. They're very simple. I wanted to be a theatrical agent.
Hmm.
I wanted to go to law school to become a theatrical agent, because my father, when things were prosperous during the 20s and he was making big money, he had a friend in Chicago named Eddie Kane, who was they called him fight owners in those days. There was no slavery terms. You owned a fighter. He used to say the owners of Joe Louis, Roxborough, and whatever they went. They were the owners. They called them owners, like owners of Tigers.
Yeah.
He owned a fighter. So Eddie Kane was a high class manager, but they called him fight owner. Eddie Kane owned the lightweight champion of the world, Sam Mandel. He built a summer home near my family's summer home at Bird Lake, and he was an Irishman out of Chicago, and my dad and he hit it off. They just loved each other. They were bosom buddies from the streets of Chicago and Detroit, and they were very close for 3 or 4 years. Well, he got my dad into the boxing world and different things, and then my dad would bring me around 5 or 6, and I'd meet these fighters, and then he'd tell me about what a great guy Eddie Kane was, and how he was a manager, and how he got 10 or 15% of his big gate. The guy who fights, he makes $300,000, and Eddie Kane sitting there gets $30,000. What a wonderful business that is for an Irishman. And so I grew up with that in the back of my craw. I wanted to, once if I were ever to get an education, I want to be a theatrical agent, okay? Well, by the time I got through that UAD law school, and I had a wife and two children, and a third one on the way, and my father said, well, whom I respected and loved very much, no, you're not going to be an identical agent. I want you in public service. So the first calling the Irish to be in public service. He preached at the table. I found out that every Irish family I knew that had any literacy, the father preached at the table public service because of the Irish heritage of not being able to have public service. That's where it comes from.
Gotcha.
All the Kennedy boys told me that their father preached public service. You can be the wastrels, you can be playboys, you can be anything you want. But what I want you to be is public service.
Uh-huh.
And they all were, every damn one of them. So my dad preached public service. I said, okay, I would never do anything of virtue. I will not be a theatrical agent. I always wanted to be. But later on when I was governor, I used to go out to Hollywood to get movies, and I'd meet with Lou Wasserman and all the big agents in America. They're all liberals and all Democrats. And the funny thing about those kind of guys that you get a kick out of it, you go to them and you think it would be a trouble to talk movies with them. No, they love politicians and politics. If you had a big office like Attorney General or higher, they loved it. Well, what's so-and-so really? They want to talk politics. So my entree would be I'd give them a half hour of politics, and they'd give me a half hour of show business. I did it when I was older. And I remember I told him, I said, Lou Wasserman, I got to be friendly with him. He was the biggest star out there. I said, would you hire me as a kid? Oh, are you kidding me? I would have loved to have an Irishman front for me. Are you kidding? We had all those acts. You could have fronted me out. You would have been a made day. Well, guess what? The year I got out of law school, Mark McCormick got out of law school in Cleveland.
Okay.
He became an agent. And his first client was Arnold Palmer. They claim that when Mark, when McCormick died, left the state of $150 million. That's what I wanted to be, but I never did. I went into public service, and I never regretted it.
So
it's kind of a habit with me. I still like showbiz.
What was your first thing then?
Pardon me?
What was your first public service?
Well, what happened was I got out of UAD, and in order to, I was working as a deputy sheriff in the sheriff's office.
My dad got that job.
In the uniform division.
Okay.
That they call a civil division. The civil division of a sheriff's office in a big city, you serve all the papers. You know, you serve the summonses, subpoenas, you do the attachments and confiscating property. You had pre-judgment, post-judgment. I was in the pre-judgment civil division, which means I served subpoenas, I served summonses, and I served injunctions, okay?
That's without uniform.
Oh, no, plain clothes.
Right.
And, it was all over western Wayne County, west of Woodward. I had that territory, one of the territory. And I knew all the streets back. So I did that. And so when I got out of law school, I still had that. But then my father wanted me to become a lawyer, of course, right away. So there was a well-known Catholic lawyer by the name of Philip J. Nudek, who had been a prominent trial lawyer in his early youth. He'd had half a dozen murder cases, and he won them all. And he was quite well known among certain circles. And he wanted me to go to work for him. So I went down to see him, and my dad was going to get me a job there at $70 a week, which is, I was making $80 a week at the sheriff's office. So 70, I could live on it. But, so I go down to see him. Well, John Cahalan, who was a political power like my dad, but he was a political power in Wyandotte. Cahalan, they were big in Wyandotte. John Cahalan comes to see him, and he wants my classmate, Bill Cahalan, who's been classing me, he wants to hire my son, Bill. Well, Nudek was, so he talks to his associates. There had a couple other lawyers. They were sharing expenses. It looked like, you know, some lawyers work. They're not in partnership, but they share a nice office. So he gets a couple other guys and says, look, I got to hire Kelly. I want to hire Cahalan, too. He says, well, we'll hire him. Just pay him half. Give him $35 a piece. So he hired us at $35.
They did that?
Oh, yeah. But I got a free office, a free secretary, and they paid my bar dues, plus anything I brought in, any fee I brought in, I got half.
Okay.
So I kept the sheriff's job for a while until I could get some half. In the first year, I got myself a pretty good case, and I started a suit in federal court in Toledo, a negligence case, got a settlement in 18 months of $18,000. The fee was six, and I got three. So for the first 18 months, they had me for nothing for wages, and I got $3,000.
What year is that?
That would have been 1963, early 63.
Okay.
And then I wanted to be a trial lawyer, and the issue then was, well, I mean, you ask me the questions. I could ramble on for 100 years.
But at that time.
Oh, by the way, all the people I worked for were all Democrats, you know. All Democratic Irish. Dudek was an Irish Catholic.
So all these connections are kind of Irish Catholic.
Yeah, oh yeah. But to get back to your question, when Frank Murphy got elected judge,
mm-hmm.
not only were the Irish getting elected because they were trusted, and then you had this big influx of Irish in Detroit,
mm-hmm.
you had the Catholics, you had all the Irish, you had, I don't know, probably 300,000 or 400,000 of them, then you had 100,000 Poles that were Catholics,
mm-hmm.
then you had 50,000 Italians who were Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not only the Irish, but it was the Catholic vote.
Yeah.
You ran, you got a Catholic vote. So, but the Irish would run and get the majority. So, and Frank Murphy's name, he got elected judge, the mayor and all that. Guess what? When I was a kid, there were seven Murphy judges. Seven. And nobody could tell them apart. Nobody could identify them unless you were an expert. But they all got elected under Frank Murphy's name. Just like people get elected on my name now.
Mm-hmm.
They run nobody for a Supreme Court last year, called her Kelly, and she gets you one.
Yeah.
And, but it's Irish. Well, Murphy was trustworthy, and I like to think I was. So they think they're voting for one of the family or something. But not only was it Irish, but you could get singular Irish. Like, there was an Irish named Brennan. At one time, there were six Brennans.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a good, decent, honest public servant, all you had to do was run on their name. But they had the political base, and it was the Catholic vote, and that was
mm-hmm.
it. And I'm sure they had probably picked up the Jewish vote too, whatever it was, about anything. But in Detroit, it was about to something, probably 25,000 votes, you know, quite a bit.
So what was the first thing, I should know this, but I don't. What was the first thing you did in a political way?
Well, what happened then was when I got out of law school, that was the key. I wanted to be a trial lawyer. And my dad said, well, fine, I'll get you in the prosecutor's office. All the trial lawyers, most of Michigan trial lawyers came out of the prosecutor's office, Flagler, all of them. They worked as assistant prosecutors, trying these dirty, rotten cases as a prosecutor. And they were slapped around by these defense lawyers, and they learned all the tricks and how to be confident, how to be cocky, how to handle it. That's why I learned to be a trial lawyer. They don't teach in law school. So I knew that, and I knew guys, and I didn't want any part of that. I didn't want to be down there with, you know, whores cases and pimp cases and narcotic cases. You know, it was bad. I didn't want to do that. And I wanted to learn to, you know, I wanted to be a white glove trial lawyer. So what happened was, my dad was all set to give me a job in the prosecutor's office. I was very close to my father. And obviously he wanted to shepherd my career because he was talking about mentor. He wanted to mentor me because I was going to be the realization of all his dreams, educated and public service and everything. And I was willing to do it. But after I had that big case that I won, I bought myself a Buick, but I didn't have quite enough money to have air conditioning. I didn't have air conditioning in it. That was a big luxury in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm driving home one day on a hot day out to where I lived in Hartwell and Melder Drive. And I get home and it's hotter than hell, about 85 degrees, a lot of humidity. And I had a nice dinner. And so then afterwards, I had a couple of kids in the stroller. My wife was pregnant for the third one that night. And I said, let's wander over to the library. So I wandered over to the library. It's a real hot night. And I walked up to the librarian and I said to her, you know, I'm going to introduce myself. A little conversation. I said, you know, you get any books about lawyers and trial lawyers or anything? Funny that you should mention that, Mr. Kelly. I just finished a nice book. I said, you did? What's it about? She said, it's about a son who writes a book about his father being a lawyer in a small Midwestern town at the turn of the century from about 1910 to 1935 or 40. It's a wonderful story about his small town country lawyer or whatever. And she said, I said, will you get it for me? She gives it to me. Well, I get home, and I remember my wife went to bed. I stayed up at 4 o'clock in the morning reading that book. Oh, my God, this very romanticized idea of what it was like to be in a small town, high respect, and how he learned to be a trial lawyer by going there young, and he got knocked around by all the old country lawyers. And the first, you know, 3 or 4 years, he was a respected trial lawyer. I said, oh, my God, this romantic version. So then I said, I wasn't ready to approach my father. So I said, I'm going to try to be a country lawyer. So University of Michigan Law School, 1949, they had this influx of GIs from the war. They graduated hundreds of lawyers more than they'd ever graduated before. What the hell are we going to do with them? So in the summer of 49, after the war, they had a study program. They sent teams of lawyers, three teams of two lawyers each, okay, to go to every county of Michigan. So the one lawyer would go and interview all the lawyers. And it was a series of 15 questions, you know. And do you think there's a room for a lawyer here? Do you think that this could do this because you're good at that? Do you think that a lawyer can make a living here? What's the thing? And how much money you make? And how many cases you have? And, of course, half the lawyers would lie. Oh, no, there's no room for a lawyer. Said, did you have any? Oh, no, I have very few cases. In the meantime, the other kids in the courthouse checking the files of all the cases filed by the lawyers. And so I got an economic report. And then they got the anecdotal interviews. Well, half the lawyers were honest, half weren't. But the book was published without using any names for guidance for lawyers. I took that, and based on that, there were the places I liked that would sound good. First of all, I wanted to go to Sheboygan, where my summer home was, you know, because I could winterize my dad's house for $500, and I could live there. I went to Sheboygan, no dice. There were 10, 12, 11 town people in the county. There was about 7 lawyers, and it was full. You know, you just couldn't cut it, and there was no openings for you. And then I went to Traverse City, because that was a nice upper-middle-class town, still is. But the problem is, because it's so nice a middle-class, there was 100 retired lawyers there. There was about 50 retired lawyers in Traverse City when I went up there, plus there was 30 or 40 practicing, and they had 29,000 people. Alpena County had 29,000 people, and they, in the entire county, they had 19 lawyers in the entire county. And in the city, they had 9. And the city had 15,000 people. I said, that's it. El Pingo looks good to me. So then I made a deal. One of my classmates was going to go up north. I said, we'll go to El Pina and get a job up there as an insurance adjuster. We'll use that as a base, and then I'll come up and be your partner. Well, that was the plan. So then I go see my dad, and my dad's heartbroken. What, my son's going to move out of Detroit on me, and I won't be here to see it on a day-to-day basis? Well, he almost cried, you know. I thought, oh, my God, I'm not going to break my father's heart. I said, well, just think about it. Think about it. You know, I said, here's what it is, Dad. I'm not going to go forever. I'll tell you what. I'll go up and I'll be a trial lawyer, and I'll come back in 3 years. Okay?
Is that what you did, 3?
Well, no.
Okay.
But I said, I'll go up, and I'll spend 3 years up there. I'll learn to be a trial, and then I'll come back, and then you can spearhead my career down here, okay? He said, well, I'll think about it. And I didn't want to hurt him, and I would not have gone. And guess what happened? My dad, being a son of an Irishman, he hires a driver. He goes up to El Pina, unbeknownst to me. Goes around, interviews every Irishman in the town. Says, you think that my son could make a living up here? You think he could be a lawyer up here? And everybody, 80% of them said, yeah, we could use a good Irish lawyer up here. Comes back and doesn't say shit. Next time he called him, he said, well, I've thought it over. He never did tell me. I've thought it all over. He said, if you promise me you'll come back in 3 years, I think it's okay. Well, okay, I'm making plans. And June 30th, I think it was, I was going to go to El Pina. And in the meantime, I got a case from El Pina. The guy that I saw up there got a call from a guy. He says, there's a guy that escaped Ionia Reformatory, a criminal sexual psychopath. Okay? And put in jail as a criminal psychopath. Nobody wants to handle a case. He said, I gave him your number. Call him. I call a guy in Anchorage, Alaska. Okay? And he tells me about how he escaped Ionia Reformatory, how he was framed by his wife and stepdaughter and put in this place as a mental thing. I said, well, and you claim you're in it? Absolutely. I said, well, would you be examined by a couple? My father was head of a Wayne County General Hospital, mental hospital in large Detroit, and the state. My dad was chairman of the board there. I said, would you be examined by 2 or 3 psychiatrists for me? See if they back you up? Well, absolutely. I said, well, fly to Detroit and I'll take care of it. So he flies to Detroit, comes in, nice looking guy. I'm examined by 3 psychiatrists, buddies of my dad, top-notch guys. Mm-hmm. And 2 days, 3 days later, come in. Frank, this guy's no more a criminal sexual psychopath than the man on the moon. The woman railroaded him. What he did, he had a nervous breakdown, and she took advantage of the symptoms and sent him away. Took his property, took everything, robbed him blind. Said, one of us will testify in court, and that'll all be all you need. So I said to my dad, well, I'm going to file a petition for writ of certiorari up there and see what to do and see if I can get this guy sprung. And my dad said, okay. Good to do that. Well, then 2 days later, my wife said, I was living with my wife in another part of town. Your dad's going up north for the summer. And we're not going to go up there for a couple of weeks to our vacation. Go over and say hello to your dad this morning. June 18th, I think it was, June 17th. I said, okay. So I went on my way, on the way to work, to the law office. I stopped and see my dad. My dad's sitting there like an aristocratic guy with silk robe on, very distinguished looking guy, nice guy. And we're talking away. And he said, well, I've decided, you know, go to El Pino, we'll work that all out. And don't worry about it, we'll work it out. And he said, Frank, you know, you worry too much. He said, you know, you're a good, smart guy, and you'll get ahead. Don't be impetuous. He said, I was the same way. I was just an orphan guy. I pushed myself as hard as I could. But unlike you, I didn't have the advantage of education. He said, you have that. He said, you'll make it. Just don't be impatient, and don't be worrying about anything. Just work hard and take advantage of your opportunities. I said, okay, Dad, I'll try. With that, he walked me out to the car in his bathrobe and puts a hand on my shoulder. I get in the car to drive away. He said, okay, I'll see you up north in a couple weeks. Don't remember what I told you. Don't worry about anything. You're going to be a fine lawyer. I drive away. The next morning, I'm going to work. I turn on the radio. Frankie Kelly, prominent Democratic leader in Detroit, died at his hospital, died in summer home in Burt Lake last evening. That's how I heard about my father dying on a car radio. Mm. Oh, so anyway, I didn't have to go up north for 3 months. Then I made arrangements to go to El Pina, and I stayed there 9 years until I was appointed Attorney General. Not only did I conquer the town, but I managed to become Attorney General. point is, I never ran for office, you know. I don't believe in running for office.
Never, ever?
Never, no. Never ran for office.
Do you want to take a break?
I was invited to run for office.
Do you want to take a 5-minute break?
Oh, sure, whatever you want.
No, do you?
No, I don't care.
Okay.
You're taking some of your pop there. You know, I got to, whatever you want. We'll go another half hour.
Okay.
Whatever you want, but take a break and...
No, let's...
I want to get to your question answered. I'm giving a lot of background here, but in all greatness, period, always remember that I was always a liberal. You know, I was always... But I didn't know any labor leaders at the Monte Man. Everybody I knew at that point, I knew through my father.
So you're...
I'll show you clippings about my father in the papers that show what he was a prominent person, what he was.
So
I've got clippings on him.
Before we meet again, it'll be helpful if they get me a copy of your resume, because that'll give me a little background that I don't have. There are
it's on Wikipedia, too. You can get it out of there.
Okay. There are a few books that did a fair amount about you that had some issues about unions, and I wanted to talk to you about some. One was this set by Dudley Buffa.
Oh, Buffa. I remember Buffa's name. Yeah, I didn't know him well.
And,
nice guy.
Yeah, and he did these two books on unions and American democracy. It's really about the UAW and the Michigan Democratic Party.
Right. Okay.
And you're quoted quite a bit.
Never saw him.
You're in there a lot. Zoltan Ferenczi's in there a lot.
Yeah. I can say all about him sometimes. When I first met him, believe it or not, he had a brush cut, okay? He had a Harvard shirt on with a nice tie and a Brooks Brothers suit, and he was trying to make it in the establishment. He was like, did you ever see a picture of Willie Nelson before he became a cowboy? When he had the white band with the shirt and tie and the whole thing, he never made it. As soon as he put on the uniform of a cowboy, he made it.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as Zoltan became a planned radical, then he got a notoriety. But unfortunately, he never won an election, except up here towards the end, he was elected a supervisor or something. But he went 180 degrees the other way, and he was always, this is off the record, he was always jealous of me, because everything came to me easy, and nothing came to him.
Right.
But he didn't realize that little ability as well. So, you know, it wasn't handed me. I worked for everything I had. But he'd work, too, but he couldn't get it because he was a Hungarian from
Delaware,
from the lower side of Detroit. But the public, even Lyndon Johnson, mispronounced his name, you remember?
And another person that kind of, I thought, crossed with you some was Sam Fishman.
Oh, Sam was a buddy of mine.
Uh-huh.
Oh, Sam, Sam is a great, great guy. I love Sam.
And so I was
Sam and I were close.
Okay. Yeah.
Sam and I were close. We had no secrets from each other. And Sam was brought in by, Bluestone. I'm not sure, but I guess Bluestone brought him in for me from the East Coast. Bluestone was kind of a Jewish intellectual for Reuther, and I think he brought Sam in. I can't verify it, but I think so.
And so I wanted to ask you a few questions about him, maybe next time.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot about you in this book, about Sid Fein's book on civil rights.
Okay.
And your activity in terms of some civil rights cases as Attorney General.
Yeah.
And some of those involve unions, not always in the positive side.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, sometimes I was put in a position where they were wrong, you know.
Right.
And against the public interest, they were pushed too hard. But between you and I, off the record, I don't believe in public unions for public employees.
Uh-huh.
I think it's a goddamn boondoggle and a ripoff.
Uh-huh.
Guess what? When I became Attorney General, we had the finest, I don't want to put anything in writing about this, I'll just background, you quoted somebody else. We had the finest civil service in the country because we had a spoil system during the 20s and 30s. And finally, the Republicans, in an act of honor when they were in control, they put in a blue ribbon, politics-free civil service. No governor, no legislature have anything to do with them. They get their own money. They gave tests of all the employees, and they set the wages, set all the working conditions, set it right. Pure civil service. And guess what? It was one of the best in the country. And that was what it was when I got here, okay? Bill Milliken, who's a friend of mine, and I like him, but Bill Milliken, in order to make sure he had union support, the next election was going to be iffy, by executive order, allowed the unions to come in. And since the day the unions came in, the workers have never had the real value wages that they had in the civil service.
Mm.
They have actually lost money every single year on purchasing power since the union came in. And the union, in the meantime, has collected millions of dollars in dues, and they aren't worth a shit. And public unions, what the hell are you public
unions? You're talking about public unions or civil service in particular?
Public employees. Public employees, any kind of public employee I know, they always have pretty good wages. I don't know any place where public employees were abused, do you? I know. They usually get pretty, they do pretty good on their own. First of all, they're all political, and they all do pretty damn good. And but it's an easy task deal for you. Just get in there and nothing, and they shake them down every year. It's a phony. I want the poor, exploited worker, the poor guy that's exploited by a corporation, and the poor, underprivileged, poverty-stricken. That's what unions are for. Not taking money under false pretenses from a bunch of white-collar civil servant types, you know. I don't believe in that. But I do strongly believe in labor unions. And I believe that the countries with the strongest labor unions have the highest civilization. My example of to the world is Scandinavian countries.
Uh-huh. Visited some or from reading?
I've traveled every one of them, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And they have it made. But, of course, the thing that they have, which is hard to go into, I don't know how we can get into it. I can't book it publicly because they'll think I'm a bigot. But the thing that you got to have, you know this guy, Queer Clyde, the guy that is the dictator in Singapore, he's written a book.
Oh, okay.
The guy that believes in the caning and everything. Well, he's considered an oriental intellectual, you know. The communists visit him. Everybody in the free world visits him because he's got some good ideas on how to make capitalism work. Well, his theory is that that mankind has not succeeded to the point as a herd animal, which, you know, he's an anthropology background. We're herd animals. Mm-hmm. He says, as herd animals, we have not had the intellectual development to the point where, as a herd animal, we care about a distant intellectual or a distant individual. We don't care about an individual we don't know outside the herd
mm-hmm.
any more than a deer cares a goddamn about a deer in the other herd, or a chimpanzee cares about a deer in the other. We don't care about the individual. What we do care about, and he makes a very strong argument, what we do care about is our own breeding family. We care about our own, our mates, our spouses, the deer we screw, the women we, you know, and our own family. So he says, if you want to have a society, you don't talk about individuals. You talk about this is good for your family. And that's what he preached. And then he said, but you've got to have cultural homogeneity. You've got to have homogeneous population. He said, when I took over in Singapore, it was one-third, I forget that country near him, it was one-third Indian, I think one-third Chinese, one-third something else. And they were all culturally, like the Arabs over there, crazy Shiites and Shuites and all that shit. It was all there. And so I was a dictator. I created four or five zones. I said, this zone must be one-third Chinese, one-third so-and-so, one-third so-and-so. And these three diverse cultures got to be, they got to use the same school, same bank, same restaurant, same everything. He said, in 25 years, I made them homogeneous. He said, I control the whole place. He said, without homogeneity, you can't do anything. He said, and so he... And
was he
said,
segregating these groups from each other or
no,
bringing
together,
them together?
Forced them to live together.
Heterogeneous, then.
Oh, yeah. They were homogeneous in the sense that they had to be together. Yeah. And one culture. So he had five cultural areas, but one-third, one-third, one-third. By the time 25 years went by, they were intermarrying. Everything
gotcha,
was gone.
Gotcha,
no,
gotcha. Okay.
It was all gone. And then he was able to... Then he catered enough. Then he said, now what I'm going to do is good for your families. And the hell with the individual. And guess what? It works. And one of the things he said, which I have trouble getting over, he says, diversity is the enemy of democracy.
Who is this guy again?
I'll give you the name of the next time we see it. He's he's written books. He's the retired prime minister of Singapore.
Okay, Singapore, thanks.
Singapore, yeah. He's worldwide. He's dying now. He's about 80 years old.
So one of the questions I wanted to ask you about was not you lobbying, but unions activity in the political sphere in Michigan and how it affected your work in as Attorney General or...
Contrary to popular belief, unions never came to me with a message that you should do this or you should do that or we want you to do this. Never. Not once.
Mm-hmm.
Their theory, and I agree with them, is if we elect people
mm-hmm.
who are sympathetic to us, who understand the problems, they will intellectually join us in the cause any more than I have to go out and give a separate lecture to every Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our Democrats I can count on that they'll be in agreement with me on certain issues. Not only, but so the union's philosophy was, elect people who we believe to be sympathetic to our cause, and that'll take care of it. They never dictated to me once, ever. I was never, they love to use that term, union dominated, you know. I was never dominated by anybody. As a matter of fact, I was probably more progressive and even more for change than even they were, you know. So they never had to worry about me. As a matter of fact, for example, when I came out against, when I came out for reapportionment, I said that apportionment is unconstitutional. I didn't consult Gus Scholl, and he didn't consult me. But he already had taken that position, okay? I had my people look at it, and contrary to any labor, I said, yeah, that the Michigan Senate is unconstitutional. And I joined the case that Scholl was in. Then we consulted.
Scholl
not
be
before,
here.
But not before. Never before. They knew that I was, you know, well, they could call me up and talk about things, but they wouldn't tell me what I had to do or tell me what, you should do this or you should do that. Never.
So anyways, I was going to ask you maybe in a follow-up about Gus Scholl, Bill Marshall, Sam Fishman, Frank Harrison.
I knew them all real well, yeah.
Right. And just sort of, again, somewhat about how the...
Well, Gus Scholl was a real intellectual.
Uh-huh.
He was a very well guy. He was so well-read and such a good strategist that Walter Reuther, the chips were down, Walter Reuther usually deferred to him. In handling Michigan politics, Reuther always made sure that the OAW had the American control of the Democratic Party to the degree they could. But on political strategy, he would defer to Gus Scholl, most of the time, because Gus was such a dedicated strategist and such a good strategist. And they agreed to most of the time. So there was some strain there because you remember it was at the national level where the national AFL, Seattle pulled away from the UAW. But that was done nationally. It wasn't done, it wasn't because of Gus Scholl and they still get along. But the union pulled away nationally. They still tend to work together here. But
there were strains between the Teamsters and the UAW. And
well, the Teamsters is a different story. That's entirely different.
Uh-huh.
The Teamsters always believed in giving a lot of money to Republicans to buy their neutrality. They were special trade unions were always survival unions. They were middle class unions and they catered to the middle class, you know. And so the building trades in the early days, some of the building trades and some of the ironworking people like that, they gave a lot of money to Republicans back in the 20s and 30s because they wanted to be accepted. And they pretty well got what they wanted, but the pressure was against the unskilled workers. That was where they wanted to save money. In the industrial age, the specialized workers didn't amount to anything, but the tens of thousands of unskilled workers, that's where the big manufacturers wanted no unions, no interference, and low wages, whatever they get. And of course, Henry Ford, when he did this, was a Democrat. Henry Ford was originally a Democrat, you knew that. Mm. When he did this, he came up with a $5 a day. A lot of these guys, like Hershey and some of these guys, were very paternalistic and very protective. But then when the workers turned on him, then they got mad, like a father with a prodigal son.
Yeah.
They got pissed off. And then the unions came in. Before he was dealt with, they were going to say, why the hell the union? Would want a union? I'm so good. Well, I'm so nice. Why would they want a union? He didn't understand that he was way behind the times and he wasn't paying people enough money, you know?
We're almost done. We're running out of time. Let me just ask you a different question. It's kind of curious. Why do you think... I'm getting a picture that you didn't sort of... Not only did you have a special role as Attorney General doing a legal job, but also you were very highly successful and you sort of didn't need to ask favors in the same way some other politicians might have, labor or other big interest groups.
And believe it or not, I had 5 governors and... The governors never used to try to tell me what to do. If they did on 1 or 2 occasions, I told them no, you know. And they never bothered me. The governors of the state never bothered me. Never said, you should take this position, that position. They just asked me, what position are you going to take? They didn't tell me what position.
So my question is why? Because that isn't true for most people.
Why? Because they didn't want to pick a fight with me.
Why?
Well, because I had more power than they did in that particular situation.
And so again, why? Well, why did you have more power than...
Well, because the Attorney General can start lawsuits, Governor can't start a lawsuit. He couldn't do it. He couldn't even hire a lawyer.
But we have Attorney General right
well,
now.
Well, they had the bloody pulpit. Put it this way. They had the bloody pulpit, but I had the power. And they figured, well, first, Timmy, did you ever read about our feuds with George Romney? Well, for 3 years, he wouldn't believe the Attorney General had power. Well, finally, at the end of 3 years, he negotiated a peace treaty of Lansing. Did you ever see a copy of it?
I can't remember if I have or not.
No, well, we'll get you a copy of it.
Okay.
And where he conceded in writing what the duties of the Attorney General are, what the duties of the governor are, and henceforth and hereafter, he'll respect those views. Now, I'm not trying to act like an arrogant, The point of it was that it was just unsaid that when I had 300 lawyers, and I could go into any court in the United States and start a suit at any time or take any action I wanted without consulting anybody, okay? The governor can't do that. And as a result, I could, if he didn't get along with me, he'd be embarrassed by the actions I took.
So I don't mean to be rude and keep repeating the question, but there's an attorney general now. There was
well, a lot of attorney generals were just followers. I was the first one to exert, in addition to all the duties of attorney general, and fine print, said attorney for the people. Well, that's when I said, I had the people on my side. I said, not only do I have to represent the legislature, the executive branch of government, and to some extent the judiciary, but number one, my number one clients are the people. And I got to see to it that the laws are applied in such a way that the people benefit from the Constitution and from the rights that they have. And I'm not going to stand still where you screw them up. And if the legislature malapportioned and the people are getting screwed, I'm going to go after you. And that's with that simple guy. Wasn't any trick to it. And they always do wherever I'd be. Wherever I'd be, I would be on the side of the people. And if you'd show me a case where I wasn't, I'll show you green blackbird.
At that time, was there a national association or activity among state attorney
generals? Yes, and I made
generals?
Them neutral. We went in and we made them neutral. We had a rule for 20 years, when I was there, 25 years, that the attorney generals, when they met in Washington, politics went out the window, and everything was on a personal basis. Now it's all gone. Now there's a Democratic attorney generals group. There's a Republican attorney generals group. They don't cooperate at all. And I had all the Republicans and all the Democrats. We'd get into a room, and we'd all agree that we're going to talk as politicians and as people about our common problems, what problems you have with the governor, what problems you have, and we'd talk as friends. And it was a collegial body, a nonpartisan collegial body for about 25 or 30 years. It was wonderful. And I didn't do it alone. We all agreed it was a smart thing to do, and we all did it. Republicans and Democrats, for example, Louis Lefkowitz was Attorney General of New York, Republican under Rockefeller. We were buddies. We never had a political argument about anything. How was the Attorney General doing in New York? How's the Attorney General doing here? How can we help each other? How can we exchange? That's all it was exchange of information to help each other be better. No partisanship of any kind. Now it's gone. It's all gone.
So did that influence come from sort of personal influence that you and he had, or was it things were just very different then in terms of bipartisan things? Or, you know, what explains?
No, it was started out, the reason it started out was there was only two or three activists and three generals of all 50 states.
Okay.
The rest were all choir boys. They just protectors of the status quo.
Meaning they were kind of appointees of who really was
well, they just
political.
Decided, they never took action. There was no consumer protection. I was the first guy to have consumer protection, environmental, intervention for cases, intervention on decay. They hardly ever did it. Maybe New York, once in a while, maybe California. But the other 48 states, never. They were just, and guess what? The average attorney general served 2 years. 2 years. And they either broke with the governor and ran against him, or they got a judgeship. You checked it, and I was the 50th attorney general, and about probably 35 of them before me became judges. The governor gave a judgeship to get rid of them, you know?
You must have been offered that at times.
Oh, yeah, sure. I didn't want any part of it.
Why'd you always say no?
Because I never wanted to be a judge. I never in my life wanted to be a judge. Too activist for that. Besides, I couldn't do that. I couldn't. I have too much.
So in our last five
years, I just can't be myself. I could never be a punisher or a truant officer or whatever you have to be a judge. I didn't want to do it. Let somebody else punish people. I don't want to do it.
Is that your father's influence or was that your UAD influence or?
No, I think it was the Irish had a lot of compassion in my family, and just like Jewish people had a lot of compassion for underprivileged and exploited people, and I had it, and I think a dim view of sitting in judgment of other people. I never wanted to be a judge.
Much of this Sid Fein book on civil rights talks about some of the things you did as attorney general and activity that went on in terms of your departments that worked on civil rights. Does that sort of follow from that same issue in terms of?
Oh, yeah. Well, the first place I put guys like Carl Levin in charge of civil rights. You know, Carl, I knew he came from a very liberal family. For example, you know, Carl and Sandy were offered different things by rich relatives, and they turned it down because they were both, I call them Yiddish Kennedys. They were both preordained to be in public service. And no matter what, they were not interested in making money. Neither was I. And so they were soul brothers on that. I knew they were. And to this day, the only difference is I know how to give up power and they don't. They'll both go in the body bag.
What about the black community, the African American community?
I've been over back to have a good relationship there always.
And so who were some of the influential people?
Well, I was in my Detroit office. I always had an Afro American person in my Detroit office, always. And their job was to make sure that they embraced the entire black community, attended every group and so on. And then I was always friendly with John Conyers and Charles Diggs, any black office holders I was friendly with, broke bread with, had lunch with, talked to them at least two or three times a year. And then through my head of my Detroit office, I would meet with all of the black pastors. During the course of a year, I would meet with each black pastor and maybe have coffee and talk about mutual problems for a half hour. So when election came, they welcomed me to their church, and I was good. Plus the fact that I had cases. I was only attorney general 6 months, and I had the famous, I had a case, I can't think of it. It'll be in my book.
That's okay.
There was a case in Palmer Park.
Yeah.
Where a white kid and a black kid fell into a fight in the bushes, and when they came out, the black kid was dead, and the prosecutor refused to issue a warrant. And for the first time in 100 years, I issued a warrant. I have a right to issue warrants. I did it. Big mistake, because I issued a warrant. Well, the black people, it was all Raton Kelly's for us. But what do? They get a former Ku Klux member as a judge. Remember, he was a paid member of the Ku Klux Klan. He was a judge. And the prosecutor, I can't think of his name right now, he was a coward, and he turned everything against me. And then when it came to jury panel, I went to pick a jury. There were no blacks on the jury panel. I couldn't get a black. I couldn't find a black in Wayne County to be on a jury. So it was an all-white jury with a Ku Klux judge. And guess what happened to me? And the lawyer I had to try the case, did you see the movie Anatomy of Murder, the part George C. Scott played? Yeah. Well, that was the lawyer. The guy that George C. Scott played was bullshit. In real life, the guy that George's guy was playing was a Will Rogers type. Oh, shucks. But he wouldn't be good as a villain in the movie, so they made him George's guy. So it was Beatty. His name was Herb Beatty. He tried that case in Anatomy of Murder, and he tried my case down here in this black case. And I quit the guy right away. And guess what? They allowed the prosecutor to take the stand and give his opinion as to the guilt or innocence of the defendant.
Uh-huh.
Give his opinion. I mean, I learned my lesson. Don't intervene with the local boys. You're just going to get. But the black community knew what was going on, and I was their champion forevermore after that. Every black leader, including the National Urban League, they were all buddies of mine. They knew that I was trying, and I did try.
I got one other question for you, and then we'll call it quits for today. So at the Dingell event that I was at, and I asked you, could we do this? You gave the kind of last speech for Congressman Dingell. You were friends for a long time, or?
No, just political allies. That's
okay.
His father, Dingell's off the record. Dingell's Polish, okay? Mm-hmm. His real name is Dingleski. His father was a sausage salesman.
Okay.
And my father and my uncle had a sausage company called Kelly's Sausage Company. And it was the largest producer of hot dogs in Detroit in the 20s, okay?
Mm.
They were all C.F. Smith stores, the ballpark. The original ballpark, Frank, was a Kelly hot dog.
I didn't know
okay.
that.
Okay, we supplied hot dogs. Anyway. So the competing sausage company was Kowalski.
Right.
Okay, they survived. Dingleski worked for Kowalski, selling hot dogs. And that's how my family knew him. And they got into politics about the same time that my dad was getting involved. And they came to my dad and they wanted to run for Congress. My dad and several other guys said, we want to run you with a nice Anglo-Saxon name. Change your name to Dingell, okay? And so they ran him for Congress. And then they got a great big Liberty Bell. And the same billboard said, ring in with Dingell. That was his first hit. Ring in with Dingell. And, of course, he what was it? Like a 32 landslide, you know? Roosevelt was landslide. He won Big. But his real name was Dingle. And so my dad and he were friends. So then John Jr., when I was a deputy sheriff and worked by finishing law school, I was a senior in law school. John had already graduated law school. He was assistant prosecutor on another floor.
Yeah.
And we would say hello, goodbye, how are you, and all that kind of stuff. You know, from Democratic families. And we knew each other. And that was it. And I sent him money when he ran for Congress from Alpena or someplace. Don't keep in touch. But just political allies. And then when I got to be attorney general, we'd have lunch once a year. And we're friends. So, but it's just political allies. I'd go to his house around Christmas time or something, have a drink. And then when I ran for senator, he helped me and stuff. During that campaign, I lost. But whenever I called him out, he helped me. And I remember one time I went to Washington. He was chairman. There's a case where you don't give up power in time. You see what happens? You wind up in crutches. And then Pelosi and the other guy from California, they take your power away. And now he's just, what is the image he's got now? Some old shuffling old guy in crutches. People think of Frank Kelly, they think of some young guy full of piss and vinegar. It's not some old fucker on crutches. You got to get out when the time comes. But unfortunately, he didn't do it, you know.
I'm going to take your picture, too, before
I leave. But he didn't do it, you know. Why don't you take it next time when I got a shirt and tie on?
I'll take it again.
All
right. Because it's fun to get a picture of you without a shirt and tie.
Okay.
Did you say at one point the Murphys had a cottage near yours or something? I misunderstood that comment. I'm sorry. You want me to wait? You want me not to? I won't.
Huh?
You want me not to take your picture?
I don't care.
Okay. I thought you said because you didn't have a tie.
I don't care.
But I thought you said something about you guys had cottage.
No. Murphy called from Detroit to my dad.
Oh, okay.
And asked to stay in our house in Detroit.
Okay.
At the same time, Welsh, the candidate for governor, was staying in our house. My dad had both candidates under his roof at one time.
Because their stuff was in Harbor Beach. And
oh, yeah. No. No, Harbor. Guess what? I'm responsible for the museum in Harbor Beach.
I've been there, and I thought I saw something about you.
I got 50,000. I shamed him into it. I finally got, maybe the best president of the UAW, the one that died, the one they all died.
Jokic?
Steve Jokic. Steve Jokic was a deputy to Frazier, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
And I said, God damn it, there'd be no UAW, but you know, there'd be no UAW if it weren't for Frank Murphy and his refusal to let the troops go to knock their heads off of Flint. There'd be no, without Frank Murphy, everybody's agreed. Well, so God damn it, we want to make a museum over there. I want 50 grand. It took me 2 years. They finally came up with 50 grand. And that's the only reason they got the museum. I got the money out of Jokic. They gave him a check and they set it up. It's, you know, a small tribute to the greatest politician we've ever produced.
Yeah. Another quick question. You mentioned we're on the west side, and I was trying to remember my only west side relative's aunt and uncle was Finkel and Outer Drive.
Who? Finkel and Outer Drive. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, I lived at Hartwell Outer Drive.
So it wasn't far from there.
Huh?
That wasn't far away.
No. Mile.
Yeah. And I can't remember what parish they were, but that's...
Were they Catholics?
Oh, yeah. All my family was.
Oh, okay.
This was a French-Canadian Catholic...
Yeah, I was just kidding Blanchard today.
Irish family. I mean, all these French-Canadians kept marrying Irish girls.
Yeah, well, what's this name here? What is his name now? What's your name? Is that French or what?
Yeah, it's a French-Canadian.
East side was all French. You know, if Frenchmen could not live on the west side, we wouldn't allow them in. But they were all on the east side. All Frenchmen, all the Belgians, all the Italians, all on the east side.
There's three waves of French Canadians to Michigan. The first is the Voyageurs, Detroit, name of the city. Next one is Saginaw, and they're lumber people.
Yeah.
And then a third one works in the copper mines mining
waves,
area. And that's my family.
Okay.
They arrived to Houghton Hancock, and then my dad's born in Red Jacket.
Okay.
In 1909.
Up and down UP?
Grandpa worked for Calumet and Heckler Copper Company.
Well, at Houghton Hancock?
Yeah, in Calumet.
Calumet
and Heckler was the copper company.
Well, they were boom towns.
Right,
Houghton Hancock in 1880, they said, well, Houghton Hancock be bigger than Detroit. And they were old letters. They had a streetcar. They had everything. They had an opera house. Jenny Lind came there.
Right.
And so all about that UP.
When my dad is born...
I always carried the UP. Except when I ran for senator, I lost UP because they thought their kids were going to be bused to Detroit because of that stupid busing. Do you remember that one? Don't you hear that?
Yeah. No. I was born in 50. I was born in 1950.
72, I ran for Senate.
Right. And in 72, I'm at U of M as an undergrad student.
Well, then you know that they used the busing against me, the busing thing. It was a joke. They beat me. They had all the people believing the kids were going to be bused to black neighborhoods.
But,
So how long, are you a tenured professor at Michigan State?
Yes.
When did that happen?
When did I get tenured?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know, about 88. I started there in 77.
You were lucky to get it.
Well,
you know, I mean, I'm sure you
But
one of the things I'm mad about is all these adjunct professors they got that they pay no money.
So I can use that when I learn from you? I assume you've done release forms before. No?
I don't mind it, but I just like to know what you're doing.
Oh,
you know, when the time comes, let me know in advance, that's all.
I will. I teach oral history and labor history, and so I was.
No, I don't want to dedicate it. You know, then they'll sue me in case I write something in a book where I got a copyright. I interfere with my copyrights.
No, you're not turning over your copyrights.
No, I know. Okay.
It's just allowing me to use it without getting in trouble.
Well, it says there I dedicate any literary or property rights to the tape recordings and subsequent transcript to the Michigan Labor Board's individuals.
Oh, it's just the old form. Well, let's cross that out.
Okay. I'm not a lawyer for nothing.
No, I'm embarrassed. I've redone the form. This is an old form, and I couldn't.
I trust guys. I don't trust them. The guy's going to screw. He's going to screw you no matter what.
But I didn't realize
that
it was the old form.
I've never had a contract. I don't have a...
I'll bring the new form next time, and I'll have you re-sign it. Anyways.
Well, I'm glad you're there. You know, I'm glad you're there, and I'm glad you're a tenured professor. Yeah. By the way, I was on that paper, that Detroit... the one they had me on the cover. Guess what? I'll give you one before you go.
So,
but I was on the cover. It won Best Road of Your Story in the United States. And guess what? It was written by Richard Willing. You remember him?
Yeah.
He was a liberal writer. He left. He kept Federal News for drinking. And the Detroit News would not acknowledge that they won the award on my biography. They wouldn't acknowledge they won the best quote of your story of the year.
I'm going to have her make a copy of a couple pages. But this talked about back in 83, how we created this as a little company to do tours for groups about labor story in Detroit. And we created this whole little company.
I knew
company.
Dick Frankenstein. I knew them all.
And so we did this book. We did these videos. All is kind of this project. And now the latest thing is I want to do a new video about the history of unions and politics.
How about the labor? Do they support you? Do they help you a lot?
Unions?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm sure they should.
But we also got in trouble.
You know, there was a lot of politics in the union, too, you know.
Right.
Ruther was not above political chicanery.
Well, that's how we got in trouble, because when we were doing this stuff in the late 70s, early 80s,
yeah.
And we interviewed some people, okay?
Yeah.
So we interviewed some people who had formerly been communists, and
yeah,
the people who were socialists raised hell with us for, why did you interview that person?
Yeah, I know.
And vice versa.
Well, not only that, Walter and all his brothers were socialists, and they took guys who were nothing. But and they said they were communists, so threw them out of the union.
Right.
One of them was Dick Leonard. Did you ever interview a guy named Dick Leonard?
We didn't, but I know who he is. I know the story.
Well, he was a brilliant guy, and they got rid of him because he was a threat to Walter.
We interviewed all those folks.
Well, Leonard died probably by the time he came around. He died in California.
Yeah.
Lavina Bieber, let's see. Buddy Battle, I knew Buddy well. He was a Herb Bluestone, great guy. Wanda Brown, I knew her.
See, this isn't just auto. It's this. It's
yeah. Yeah. Are you Millie Jeffrey?
I knew Millie pretty well.
Huh?
Millie?
Millie, yeah. You didn't get her in the interview here.
We didn't?
You didn't have to. Evidently, no.
Well, we did stuff about her. And I've interviewed her.
Well, she was one of the persons.
She was
one
great
of my
lady.
Good friends too.
Yeah. But anyways, we got in trouble from both
John
sides.
John Prince was another protege of mine.
Who we did or didn't interview, you'd get in trouble with. And it was so we're doing these interviews in 78 to 82, and that eventually would lead to that book and lead to
Syria.